I'm gonna go ahead and jump in. We have some people come in a couple minutes late, and that's okay. Glad you all are sharing time with us this afternoon. Mm-hmm. I know typically at these lectureships, it's very difficult when you look at that long schedule of things to determine what to go to. So thank you for coming in here. We're going to be talking about something that is near and dear to my heart that I've been thinking about for a very long time. And I hope, in the context of what we do this afternoon, for you to be able to engage a little bit. I think that preaching and teaching are two very different things, very different tasks. And so what's going to happen in here this afternoon is really teaching. And because it's teaching, I'm going to allow you to engage this a little bit. So if during the things that I say, if there's something that you want to talk about a little bit, let me know. We'll stop right there and kind of move through it, and we'll engage each other that way. So feel free to do that in this setting. My name is Wes Crawford. Those of you who don't know, I am the preaching minister at Glenwood Church of Christ in Tyler, and also teach some courses for Abilene Christian University on a regular basis. I teach their church history and restoration history classes, and periodically still will teach a class at Lubbock Christian University in their graduate program as well. I have some friends here from Lubbock that used to live in Lubbock for quite some time, where all my wife's family is, and so I have a great place in my heart for that little city where it's raining, actually. Very strange phenomenon there. Now, I've spent the better part of the last 15 years studying and researching the black church generally and African-American churches of Christ specifically. And probably when you hear me say that, you may ask the question, why? Here's this white guy sitting in the front of the classroom. Why has he been studying black churches for all this time? And in order to answer that question, I want to tell you a little story. I was the preaching minister at Orient Street Church of Christ in Stamford, Texas. Stamford with an M, not an N. It's about 40 miles north of Abilene. I was preaching there full-time when I was finishing up my MDiv at ACU. And so I was 22 years old, first preaching job, out of the gate. I knew nothing. And for some reason, they paid me a salary to come up there and speak. And it was just like being thrown into the deep end. But it was a phenomenal experience. The reason I begin with Stamford is I want to introduce you to a little woman named Corrine Horn. Corrine Horn was a former preacher's wife. And from the first Sunday I was there, Corrine Horn always sat in the same seat, in the same pew, right up toward the front. I could still see on my right-hand side, she's sitting right here on the aisle. And I got to know Corrine very well in the first couple of years when I was preaching. Corrine lived until 93, and then she passed away. It was one of the first funerals that I ever conducted as a minister, and so I'll always remember it. But I'll always remember it for other reasons. She was a giant of a woman, spiritually. She was very small in stature. She was a giant of a woman spiritually. So I lived her whole life within the church, in the middle of church leadership. She and her husband were very instrumental in leading a church there in Stamford. And when he passed away, long before I met Corrine, she became a member here at Orient Street Church of Christ, the little black Church of Christ that had been there for a long time. When he passed away, it just kind of went away. And the last remaining members, they just kind of all blended into this one congregation in Orient Street. When Corrine passed away, I remember we were at the building doing the service, had the memorial service, and then we all went outside and were ready to follow the sheriff's deputy over to the cemetery. I remember getting in that long procession, following the hearse, and we made our way past the church building and down the main street, one of the only streets in Stamford. And just when I thought we were about to turn into the Memorial Cemetery, which I had been to a couple of other times since I had arrived in Stamford, the cars kept going. And the sheriff kept moving past that cemetery, and we turned onto the highway, and the cars kept going. And I wondered, where has he forgotten the way to the cemetery? Where are we going? We made it out to the highway about 5 miles out of town. We turned off into this little road that I'd driven past many times and didn't realize was a road. We proceeded down this pothole-infested dirt path covered by trees all around. It was very obvious that not many people had traveled this road. And we made our way through this path for about 10 minutes. And then the car stopped and we pulled over into this obviously recently mowed pasture. And we got out of our cars and we watched where we were stepping. This was, you know, West Texas, rattlesnake country. So we're being very careful as we walked past. And there was this little spot that was cleared off more than most. And I was able to see a tombstone, a marker, where her husband had been buried. And right next to that was the place where we would bury Corrine. Come to find out, the reason we were there was because there was a time when African-American people were not allowed to be buried in Memorial Cemetery in Stanford. In fact, when her husband passed away, they were not allowed to be buried in the same cemetery. And so she wanted to be buried next to her husband, and so there we were in the middle of this field, ungroomed. Obviously, it had not been mowed in a very long time, except for the little spot where we were going to be, where somebody had come out that day and mowed it. Other than that, the weeds were waist high all around this buried, forgotten cemetery. And that was a very eye-opening experience for me. Because I realized that here was this woman that had really given her life to God, had given her life to the church, had spent all of these years doing all these wonderful things. And she was going to be buried outside of the city of Stanford. And in a matter of a couple of weeks, those weeds would grow up again. And her plot would be hidden. And the reason she was denied spot in a main cemetery is because of the color of her skin. I was 22 years old. I was a preacher, graduate student at Abilene Christian University. And it was during that time that I became acquainted more than ever with the writings of Martin Luther King Jr. And perhaps his best-known speech, and I've debated with students before whether it was actually a speech or was it a sermon that he preached, King challenged Americans to envision a new kind of America. And these words are very familiar to you. He said, "I have a dream that one day little black boys and black girls will be able to join hands with little white girls and white boys and walk together as sisters and brothers." As we drove down that dirt road path, pothole infested road, in this abandoned African American cemetery, I came face to face with a startling reality. We were at that time 40 years removed from Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech. And little black boys and little black girls were still very separated and still very much awaiting racial equality. And interestingly, although if you go to the United States Capitol, you will see African American and white and Latino people serving Congress together and engaging in business together, those same Americans are still very much segregated on Sunday mornings. So both as a minister and as a student of religious history, I saw and was troubled by the great racial injustice that is still very much present in the world and also in many of our congregations. The Jim Crow signs, many of them have disappeared. We do not have segregated water fountains anymore. Most restaurants in America, an African-American and white person could sit down and eat together. Nevertheless, few religious organizations enjoy full egalitarian life in our world. And as for religious institutions, I think that is a very much a shame. So I became convicted that instead of harvesting these seeds of segregation, institutions of religion should actually be leading in the efforts to break down these walls of injustice. And one of the keys to that challenge is first uncovering what happened and owning it and acknowledging it. I was at a conference just earlier this week in the middle of Los Angeles with Jerry Taylor, and we were talking together and saying, before you can begin to work the work of reconciliation, there has to be some truth-telling. We have to acknowledge what has happened. We can't just sweep it under the rug. You can't just ignore it and try to move on with life. You have to talk about what has taken place. Because we're here in Southern California, maybe it's appropriate to quote one of the guys that came from here, Ronald Reagan, said in 1989, his farewell address, "If we forget what we did, we don't know who we are." I think that's really important. The reason I've spent the last 15 years of my life studying this, poring over some of these stories, is because I want to make sure we don't forget. I want to make sure we don't forget who we are. I think that's really important, because all of these stories, all of the good stories and the bad stories, all of them shape us. They all give us our identity. We grow, I think, from learning from our mistakes. Learning about the things that we did that were good and bad. We're given great courage to move forward by learning from some of these victories. And so that's why I've done this. All that to say, this is why you have a white guy in the middle of standing in the middle of classroom talking about black church. All right. So now you understand a little bit. So today and tomorrow, what I'd like to do is share with you some of both. Some of the victories, some of the great stories, and some of the places where we have failed and sometimes failed miserably. And from the outset, I want to share with you the conclusion of the story. This is going to break all storytelling rules. Most of the time when you tell a story, you have to save the punchline for the end. But I'm going to tell you right from the beginning. So here it is. Here's the conclusion. Race and racism has divided churches of Christ as much as it has divided any other Southern Christian group. Yet, key aspects of our identity, part of who we are, key aspects of who we are, have masked from full view the degree of our separation. So for generations, both African American and white leaders within Churches of Christ perpetuated an illusion of racial unity. We acted as if things were okay, and we moved forward. We created this illusion of racial unity. But during the period of the American Civil Rights Movement, that illusion was shattered, resulting in both physical and theological separation between two racially defined and distinct movements. That's the conclusion. So if all you want is the conclusion, you can go listen to Randy Harris, because I think he's speaking right now and tomorrow. But if you want to hear, I'm going to kind of explain why I've come to some of these conclusions. Now, if you are familiar at all with the story of African American Churches of Christ, there are some names that you're probably very familiar with. How many know the name Marshall Keeble? George Philip Bowser. You know some of these names. Those are some of the more familiar names, and we're going to talk about those guys. Very important names. But there are some other less known names that we're going to be talking about as well. And the first person I want to introduce to you is a guy named Moses Lard. Now, if you're going to have a name like Lard, you've got to do something important. He did something, I don't know if you call it important, but it was important. It was very interesting what he did. He lived in the mid-19th century. He edited a paper called Lard's Quarterly. It was not uncommon in those days for individuals to establish their own journals, their own religious publications, and name those journals or religious publications after themselves. And so he did, Lard's Quarterly. As you know, the mid-19th century was a very tense time in America. And it was for many American churches as well. So, for example, 1845, the Southern Baptist Convention officially separated from, at that time, the Triennial Convention. So there was now a Southern Baptist Church and a Northern Baptist Church. In 1844, just a year before, the Methodist Episcopal Church South was born, in contrast to the Methodist Episcopal Church. So this southern group officially separated and formed their own denomination. In fact, most American Christian groups during this mid-19th century divided along racial lines, along northern-southern lines, and they had these official separations. They publicly disagreed on the issue of slavery. They publicly divided north and south, and their divisions were very official. Now, the reason I bring up Moses Lard, in 1866, okay, so we're 20 years removed from some of these major separations that took place in a very public way. In 1866, Moses Lard published an article in his journal entitled, "Can We Divide?" And among other points that he made in that article, he relished in the fact that the Church of Christ, or as he said, the Church, did not divide. He said the Methodists may have divided, the Presbyterians may have divided, the Baptists may have divided, but not us. And other historians around the same time, some people that even followed him, agreed with his assessment. So he had these well-known Stone Camel Movement restoration history historians, A.T. DeGroote, W.E. Garrison, if you're familiar with any of these names, they argued that the disciples of Christ and churches of Christ, though they did eventually divide from one another, their division had nothing to do with slavery. And it had nothing to do with North and South divide, had nothing to do with the reasons that these other groups divided from one another. In fact, Lard takes great pride in this essay in saying that churches of Christ were one of the very few religious groups that did not divide. I'm not convinced. In fact, I would say we did divide. So I want you to take a closer look. Think about this. Most people, when they point to the division between churches of Christ and disciples of Christ, their red letter date is 1906. Okay, 1906 is we could jump into this and talk about this a long time. The division happened much earlier than 1906. The reason 1906 is held up as the date is because when they were getting ready to do the United States religious census during that time, the leader of the religious census was in his research looking at a lot of religious publications in order to find the data that he needed. And he was reading from the Gospel Advocate, and he was reading from the Christian Standard, these two journals that were from this group. And he noticed that, oh my goodness, these don't sound anything alike. And in fact, there are some of these churches that seem to be located around this journal, and there are other churches that seem to be located around this journal. And so he picks up the telephone and the time, and he talks to a guy named David Lipscomb. He says, "Mr. Lipscomb, I've been reading these journals, and I just have a question for you. Are there two different movements here, or is this one?" And Lipscomb said, "There are two." And that was in 1906. And that is the reason that the two groups officially divided. Officially is a key word in this conversation because we did not have anything, any official body to name the division the way Baptists did, the way Presbyterians did, the way Lutherans did. And so our division happened much less formally and over a long period of time. But we did divide. And what's interesting, if you look at the division, when they finally did divide, 90% of the churches that eventually became disciples of Christ churches were in the north. 90% of the churches that eventually became churches of Christ were in the south. This was a north-south split in every sense of the word. There's no way around it. And while there may not have been an official physical division between these two groups in the mid-19th century, a theological divide certainly had already occurred, and here's how. If you look at the issue of slavery, what's interesting is that with the Bible as their authority, northern members of the movement were supporting their position. And at the same time, southern members of the movement, with the Bible as their authority, were supporting their position. How is that possible? It's possible because in the middle of the 19th century, toward the latter half of the 19th century, these two groups developed distinct biblical hermeneutics. They were very different from one another. And that's where the real division really began to take shape. The Southern Churches of Christ folks maintained a strict patternistic reading of Scripture that allowed them to justify slavery. The Northern and eventual disciples of Christ, they were reading Scripture differently. They could not read it looking for a pattern, because to read it looking for a pattern would only end in the support for slavery. So they had to change the way they read Scripture. Yes?
Weren't they educated differently?
They were educated very differently. Very differently. Education played a huge role. And it's a subject we don't have time to jump into too deeply. But they were divided economically. They were divided by education. They were divided regionally. Significant divisions were taking place here. And one of the things that happened, we may talk about it a little bit tomorrow, but one of the things that happened in the Churches of Christ in the second half of the 20th century is that a theological divide began to happen in that movement as well, and a lot of it centered on education. That has a lot to do with some of these divisions within our own movement. So what I want you to see at this point is a theological separation was beginning to take shape between disciples of Christ and churches of Christ. And it only finally became official in 1906 because the U.S. government came in and asked, hey, is this one movement or two? And by that point, Lipscomb said, we're two movements. So 1906, he receives the call. He says, yes, the official division takes place. But the real division had been taking place for a very long time. And the reason these two groups disagreed about instruments, and the reason they disagreed about missionary societies, these were just the symptoms. What really divided these two groups by 1906 was they had developed two distinct ways to read the Bible. And that changed everything. Okay? By the time you got to the beginning of the 20th century, and instruments came up, and missionary societies came up, and paid local preachers came up, all those kinds of things, those are really just symptoms. These two groups were divided because they were reading Scripture differently. And so it didn't matter what issue you threw on the table. They were gonna have different conclusions because they were reading the Bible differently. Now, that's very, very important. So in a way, this division between disciples of Christ and churches of Christ in the mid-19th century was the same division that had taken place earlier with some of these other groups, Baptists and Presbyterians and Lutherans. The only difference is, in the middle of the 19th century, we did not have an official organization to declare that we were dividing. But we divided. Sometimes, in a movement like ours, that's how division occurs. It's very informal. And sometimes it can remain unrecognized until decades have passed. So lacking a formal, centralized governing body, what has served to unite this seemingly disconnected group? Anybody have an answer to that? What has served as our locus of cohesion, if you will? There are three things that people have pointed to. Our journals, okay, our colleges, and our lectureships. Okay, we're at one of them. Okay, we're actually kind of at two of them. We're on the campus of a university at a lectureship. So these three things have served to unite this group, and they've taken the place of official denominational structures that hand down laws, that hand down orders, that hand down direction and theology and identity. These three things have helped shape us and unite us more than just about anything. So those three entities are very, very important. And why it's important for us, the reason I bring that up, is because for most of our history, those three things, the journals, the colleges, and the lectureships, have perpetuated an illusion of racial unity within churches of Christ. If your only orientation to America was Churches of Christ journals in the mid-20th century, you would never know that the American Civil Rights Movement had taken place. It's just not there. It's not talked about. Most of our colleges remain segregated nearly a decade after the Supreme Court mandated that they integrate. And while America was embroiled in the civil rights movement, this is a really good one, while America was embroiled in the civil rights movement, you have sit-ins and marches, and there are church bombings, and there are freedom rides, and you have Birmingham and Selma and the March on Washington, the long hot summer, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X. While all these things are taking place, listen to the names of the themes of Churches of Christ lectureships during that period. The Restoration Principle. The Church and Morality. Biblical Doctrine and the Last Things. Christ and the Space Age. There is not one theme in all of those years centered on race or segregation or the Civil Rights Movement. If your only orientation to America during that time were Churches of Christ journals and lectureships and colleges, you would never know the Civil Rights Movement had taken place. It was as if it never happened. These key identity-shaping organisms within Churches of Christ completely ignored the Civil Rights Movement. In fact, that's even to say too much. Not only did they ignore it, they ignored the fact that there was even a problem within the church. In 1964, Rule Lemons was then editor of the Firm Foundation Journal, which at that time was a very widely distributed and very formational journal within Churches of Christ. It was in league with Gospel Advocate when Gospel Advocate had a huge readership. Okay, so the editor, very influential person within Churches of Christ in 1964, okay, says, and I quote, "We do not believe that segregation has ever been a problem in the Lord's church. The kingdom of heaven is the most completely integrated institution that we know, and all of the brethren accept all of the brethren as brethren. We have never had a problem here." If your only orientation to Churches of Christ were our journals and our colleges and our lectureships, you might just leave with that impression, because it's never mentioned. So throughout the first half of the 20th century, leaders in Churches of Christ perpetuated this illusion of racial unity. White journals, colleges, lectureships largely ignored racism or segregation. Now here's an interesting piece of this story. Out of necessity, and I want to be careful here, I want you to hear these first part of what I said, out of necessity and for a purpose, many African American leaders refused to challenge racism either. Instead, those leaders worked within a system of segregation. And the most visible and vocal leader of African Americans throughout the 20th century was a guy named Marshall Keble. Now, I want to share with you an exchange that took place with Marshall Keble and a guy named Foy Wallace. This exchange, simply put, staggers the mind. I remember working with my dissertation chairman at Vanderbilt, and he's an African-American man. He's a bishop in the AME church. He's lived his world studying racism and segregation and all this history. And he read this exchange, and he literally had no words about how to respond to this. And I just want you to listen to what took place. The year was 1941. Foy Wallace was a fiery, white, and very racist preacher within Churches of Christ. And he found out through word of mouth that there was a preaching trip that had taken place recently. Preaching trips are very common in those days, where preachers would go and they'd spend weeks at a time preaching all over the country. And he found out that on one of these trips, an African American and a white preacher within Churches of Christ were in a town, and they were staying in a home of someone that only had one room to give them. And so this African American and white preacher stayed in the same room and in the same bed that night. And word got back to Foy Wallace. He was indignant. And he wrote that such an action was a violation of Christianity itself. And he went on to share his disgust with African Americans in the world that were working for social equality. And he reminded his readers in this essay about Marshall Keeble, an individual, he wrote, that could never be spoiled by such activities. But then he concluded by saying this, "But," he said, "if I ever hear that Keeble has done anything akin to this, then I will take back every good thing I've ever said about him." Now, the reason I wanted you to hear this has less to do with the racist comments of Floyd Wallace, but more to do with Keeble's response. After reading Wallace's tirade in the Bible Banner, which was Floyd Wallace's journal at the time, Keeble sent a reply, which Wallace also published in the Bible Banner in the next edition. And here's the brief response. "Dear sir and brother in Christ, for over 30 years, I've tried to conduct my work just as your article in the Bible Banner of March suggested, taking advice from such friends as you have been for years has been a blessing to my work. So I take the privilege to thank you for that instructive and encouraging article. I hope that I can conduct myself in my last day so that you and none of my friends will have to take back nothing they have said complimentary about my work or regret it. Please continue to encourage me in my work and pray for me. Fraternally yours, M. Keeble." As I said, my chairman was reading this, and he read it again, and he read it again. He could not fathom why Marshall Keeble would respond this way. I don't have enough time to recount all of the reasons that I'm about to say what I'm going to say, but you can read it in the book. There's a book about this. But what I want to say is this. Keeble was no pushover. He was not weak. I think Keeble was calculating. I think he recognized the world that he lived in, and he acted accordingly. For Keeble, the most important thing was the communication of the gospel. And if he had to, on occasion, publicly acquiesce to white racism in order to proclaim the gospel, he did it. If he had to maintain friendships with people like Foy Wallace in order to have an audience with everyone that he wanted to have an audience with, white or African American, he did it. So, for the first half of the 20th century, this illusion of racial unity was perpetuated by whites and by African Americans. Whites ignored the problem, and African Americans, most notably Keeble, also help support this illusion. Keeble is one of the very few African Americans during this time to speak at white lectureships. He wrote regularly in the White Gospel Advocate, and he was also writing in other white journals of the time, and he never called attention to racism. He visited white colleges and never mentioned racism. For many whites within Churches of Christ, Keeble was the face of African Americans for the church. And if Keeble seemed okay, I'm sure everybody else is okay too. And that illusion continued for a very, very long time. But things were not okay. And there was an alternative stream within African American circles that was becoming more and more vocal and more visible in the middle of the 20th century. So if Marshall Keeble was the Booker T. Washington of our movement, there was someone else, a name we've already mentioned today, George Philip Bowser. George Philip Bowser was more in line of the W.E.B. Du Bois. He was the protest voice within the movement. So compare these two stories. One, you've heard the story of Keeble's exchange with Foy Wallace. Now listen to another episode from the life of Bowser. He was a contemporary of Keeble, but they did not approach racism in the same way. One episode in his life will shed light on this. The year was 1920. Bowser moved to Nashville to become the principal of Southern Practical Institute. Bowser, throughout his whole life, worked for the cause of education. Started many different schools for African Americans, trying to educate African Americans and move people forward. Well, 1920, he was appointed this new school's principal. A white man, C.E.W. Doris, served as the school's superintendent. On the first day of the school's operation, Doris mandated that African Americans enter that school through the back door. Keep in mind, it's an African American school. And he mandated that the students enter their own school through the back door. The administrators and the teachers and everybody else who was white could enter through the front door. Bowser objected, very publicly objected to this. And he said that Doris needed to reconsider his position. Doris refused. And immediately Bowser resigned. He went back to where he came from. And not only did he resign, he encouraged students from the school to follow him. And so 6 weeks after it opened its doors, it closed its doors for lack of students. Okay, this was the difference in Bowser and Keeble. One was kind of a protest voice. One was more of a publicly acquiescing voice. This protest stream within Churches of Christ among African Americans was there for a long time. But it became louder and louder as the century progressed. And this voice was seldom heard within white corners of the movement. Bowser published his own journal. It's called The Christian Echo. He also established many of his own schools that were for African Americans. And none of them had a lot of staying power. Bowser's protege, a guy named Richard Nathaniel Hogan, who people in this part of the world will probably know about, he would carry on that protest stream. He was one of his students and moved that position forward. But again, his voice was not often heard among white members of the movement. But the voice would eventually be heard. Now, I have about 5 minutes left, it looks like, right there. And I'm about to jump into Nashville Christian Institute, which is kind of a key part of this story and one that there may be some dialogue about. So I just want to stop here and just see. Do you have any questions? Do you have any? If you have questions or something, say, we may stop here because we got 5 minutes left, and 5 minutes is not a lot of time to jump into this next part of the story. So I am perfectly content to field any questions or dialogue with you about any of this so far. Yeah, Ray?
I knew Marshall Keeble.
Oh, okay.
That's one of the advantages of being old. And even think back, it's hard for me to imagine the world that I lived in and the worldview that I had. But you nailed it. Brother Keeble knew what he had to do and what he had to say to establish churches. And he established essentially every black church in Texas and of course, beyond that.
Yeah.
But I'm familiar with Texas because he told me, when I need money, I pray to Texas. And of course, that was in Cuba. Yeah. But the reality was, he knew how to get the white man to open his pocketbook.
Yeah.
And Tyler, West Irwin,
yeah,
established the North Tenenbaum Church. Well, we thought separate but equal was a good thing. And so I'm not saying that to justify either side, but that was a reality. Tanya Bryce.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay, Tanya and I were at a conference earlier this week.
She was in Waco for a while, and I got to know her. And she said that Brother Keeble had many disciples, of course, but two of them were Fred Gray and Jack Evans. And I happened to know Brother Evans, too. But Fred Gray was more of a man of quiet nature, but then Brother Evans was more...
Was not.
but timing was everything,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
Because it, well, we can't imagine how trapped we are in our own culture, in our own world.
Yep.
And so I'm saying that as a repentant man for whom all of us, it was so easy. The church I worked with in Navasota, Texas, a missionary came in. I wasn't there then, but a missionary, an African-American missionary, came to visit the church in Navasota, Texas on a Sunday morning, and they served him communion at the back door.
Mm-hmm.
And sent him on his way. And it's hard to tell that story. It's hard to imagine that story. But I had worked for a summer while I was in A&M with that church, and they wouldn't let me mail out to the community our gospel meeting. And this was 1963 or something like that. Mm-hmm. I couldn't mail out to the community because some of the mailouts to the invitation might go to the wrong houses.
Well, Keeble's an interesting figure, and I'll say this: there, for a long time, the story about Keeble, there was biography written about Keeble, there's other articles written about Keeble, and all of them very much painted him as a very quiet, meek, mild man that rarely confronted any of this. However, I will say that there were stories where that is not the Keeble that showed up. I mean, there were things that Keeble did privately and in the company of other African Americans that were very different, that I think really shed light on who he really was. I think he did work within the system to keep Nashville Christian Institute alive for as many years as it was alive, and is raising money and everything else. But I think there are some stories that illustrate what he really believed about this, and he was troubled by a lot of the things that took place.
Yeah, he knew the word.
Yeah, well, he's a tremendous preacher. But we're going to talk about some of the names you mentioned tomorrow, Jack Evans and Fred Gray, Nashville Christian Institute, and a lot of that story, to kind of foreshadow a little bit. There's something that happened around the closing of Nashville Christian Institute that finally allowed this illusion of racial unity to shatter. And it became very public, and those two racially defined groups would never be the same. And so we're going to talk about that tomorrow. Anybody else? Yeah.
I've always heard this saying, meekness is not weakness, it's
right.
Strength under control.
Although
we can't really walk in their shoes and understand the context of when they were living.
Mm-hmm.
They did what they did for what they thought were the right reasons.
Right.
I think you can't, even someone like Keeble, you can't,
can't put him in a box.
For whatever reason, he thought what he was doing was right.
Exactly. And he did some tremendous things, wonderful things. Yeah, very, very powerful, influential man. Yeah. Yes, sir?
I don't know how practical this class is intended to be, but we're in a relatively small city, about 60,000 people. The church is not a Church of Christ town.
Mm-hmm.
There has been a railroad track, obviously, and so Michelle and I, we worship at the historically black congregation, mm-hmm. on the historically black side of town, which, because of property values, is not really as black now.
Right.
You know. And then on the other side of town is the white historically white congregation. And both congregations are graying out.
Mm-hmm.
Right? We're the kids.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're over 50 and we're the kids. So on a Sunday, we might have, say, 30 or so.
Mm-hmm.
The other congregation might have, I don't know, 50, 45.
Yeah.
Not that different. And the preacher on the, circle mm-hmm. white side,
yeah.
Our preacher had recently passed away. Oh,
mm-hmm.
Our congregation's never had elders either, and we
mm-hmm.
might get into some historical
yeah.
things
yeah.
that way in the community. But he passed away, and someone who's really wasn't prepared but was kind of pushed up to do it,
yeah.
because there's a little, the preacher on the white side of the town, the white, historically white congregation, is saying, why don't we join together?
Mm-hmm.
And it's fascinating to be in our congregation and see that, I don't think so.
Yeah.
And it reminds me of this movie, The Lackawanna Blues, which for every door that was opened, another door closed.
Yeah.
and they don't want that door to close. There's fear. There's a lot of fear.
Well, there's fear.
Some's justified.
There's different motivations on both sides. I mean, really, you had to characterize just these two sides. But one of the problems is historically what's taking place is when you have multiracial congregations, typically the way that's played out is it becomes less a merger and more of one of them kind of gets lost.
Right.
And it's usually the black congregation that gets lost. Because
the preacher's trying to go against that possibility by saying, why don't we sell both properties? Because you're right, whichever house even in corporations, whoever's financial system remains intact.
Yeah.
You know that one.
Yeah.
You know, one.
Yeah, where's the money and where are the leaders?
Yeah.
That's a key. But, you know, that may be a tremendous place for some of this to happen. It sounds like it's kind of an equal size and equal.
Yeah. It sounds like an opportunity.
It could be an opportunity.
It's a risk.
It'd be interesting. Yes, sir. Last question that I've been all about. I don't know if somebody's waiting for this room after us or not. Do what?
Was there another question?
No.
I think one of the challenges with this topic is, to me, the church reflects the community it's in.
Right.
So, like, for most of us from Chicago, Chicago's 50 communities that are divided by race.
Yeah.
And the church simply, it's a subset of it. It reflects the community.
That's right.
I remember maybe 15 years ago, I came to Sacramento for half a year to work. It was culture shock because, you know, one thing you go visit someplace, another place you live.
Yeah.
And even just being with the church, it was like night and day.
Yeah.
But they reflected the community they were in.
Yeah, this is, you know, we would be extremely misguided to say that this is just a church problem. I mean, this is if not... It may not have been good to say this is an American problem. This may be the American problem, and it has been from the beginning, and that's reflected in our churches. And we can say a lot more about it, and we will tomorrow. So thank you all for being here. I will see you tomorrow.